Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer and this is Hitler, Copperface Jack and Body Snatching, the real history of St. Stephen's Green. Stephen's Green is one of Dublin's most famous places. Located in the south inner city, today it's a pretty park surrounded by some of the city's most picturesque buildings. These house the Royal College of Surgeons, government departments and one of Dublin's most famous hotels, the Shelburne. The area is also one of Dublin's most famous shopping districts. Grafton Street, for example, commands some of the most exorbitant retail rents in the world. Its history, however, is very, very different. In this podcast, historian Frank Hopkins, who has published a book on St. Stephen's Green, joins me to talk about the less well-known histories of this area. Now, these are really fantastic and funny at times, and if you think you know the history of St. Stephen's Green, trust me, the real story is a lot different. Now, we're going to kick off back in the late Middle Ages, when the Green was one of what Frank calls Dublin's killing grounds. Then we'll weave our way through public executions, the brothels that used to frequent the area, stopping in Copperface Jack's to find who the real man behind the notorious nightclub was, and then we'll finish up in the early 20th century when a certain Mr. A. Hitler was a regular sight around Stephen's Green. When the show is over, you can get Frank's book, and by the end of the episode, you'll definitely want to. There's a link in the show notes below, but it's called St. Stephen's Green, A History of the Green and Its Environs, and it's available pretty much everywhere. You'll also see in the show notes this week's special supporters mentioned as well. Each week I'm listing show supporters in the show notes as a mark of gratitude. The show is currently entering a new phase, not only in terms of an increase in episodes, but also in producing content that dives deeper into original sources, making what I hope will be better shows. For example, around June the 1st, I'll be releasing the first episode in a new series that has taken years to put together. It's actually a return to a story I covered a few years back called Murder at Mother Mountain. Over the last 2 or 3 years, I've been researching this case, and with the support of listeners on Patreon and Acast Plus, I was able to bring on board Liam Costello to help with the research after I realised how complex this story was. Now, Liam and myself have uncovered a huge amount of detail that's changed what I thought the original case was about. It's developed into a 5-part series that's a deep dive into pre-famine Ireland set to the backdrop of true crime. I'm really excited about getting this one out because, as you'll hear, it's something a bit different, but only possible because of show supporters allowing me to take the time needed to work through parish registers, prison records, old letters and various archives to piece together this intriguing story. If you want to support the show, you'll be helping make this kind of podcast that involves original research not available anywhere else. Now, your support makes a big difference and you get bonus features in return, such as ad-free content, early access to the show and extra episodes. You can find out more at patreon.com/Irish History or Acast Plus. I have links to that in the show notes below as well. Finally, I will say today's podcast is probably not suitable for younger ears. So if they're listening out, maybe slip on the earphones at this point and we'll dive into the show now. St. Stephen's Green can be a tranquil oasis in Dublin today. It's got beautiful Georgian buildings that surround a large park, so it's a great escape from the hustle and bustle of the city. The carefully tended gardens and ponds are an oasis of calm. However, its origins are so different. Before we get into the fascinating stories of the characters who frequented this part of the city over the last few centuries, Frank gave me a brief overview of St. Stephen's Green and where it came from.
Everybody knows that it's this lovely, lush, well-kept jewel in the crown of Dublin Corporation. And it's this walled in enclosure. But back in the day, back in the 1600s, the Green was a marshy wasteland. Nothing really happened there. People used to go there to shoot birds and to hang people. not at the same time. But it was a floodplain of the Steyne River. The Steyne flowed under the Green, and the Green itself was a floodplain of the River Steyne. The name St. Stephen, it comes from St. Stephen's Church, which is a medieval church in the area. It's where kind of Mercer's Medical Centre now is. So it was based around that. There was a leper hospital there as well. It began to be developed in 1663 when the Dublin city was broke from various wars and the Civil War and rebellions and things like that. So they decided to, they took 17 acres of the green and broke it into lots and auctioned them off to various people. And there was 86 parcels of land. And these were bought by merchants, bakers, tradesmen and other professionals. And they began to develop into the square that we know today. It was enclosed and gated in 1666, and the park was levelled, but it was mainly used for His Majesty's horse as well as the Dublin militia. But despite the work that went into it, the park was literally a tip for the city. It was full of rubbish and there was constant complaints about it. Now, efforts were made to clean it up in 1780, but the decline continued apace. And in 1798, the park was absolutely ruined because of the constant usage by the Dublin yeomanry, and it was a complete mess. Matters began to improve somewhat in 1814 when the Green was privatised by an Act of Parliament, and commissioners were installed to take over the running of it. The old walls were demolished, ditches surrounding them were filled in, and the park was drained and levelled. Trees and shrubbery were put in, but one thing that became a major bone of contention, only residents of Stephen's Green were allowed to use it. So protests rumbled on about that for about another 60 years until Sir Arthur Guinness bought it, and he offered to pay commissioners to open it to the public. And so that's when it became the park that we know and love today.
If we turn the clock back and look at the earlier history of the general area, St. Stephen's Green was perhaps best known as an execution ground. These executions were very different from what you might be thinking. Frank explains how they were halfway between a public entertainment and punishment.
Effectively, for a few centuries, it was the killing fields for Dublin. Of course, there'd be a spectacle. Many miscreants were taken from, or condemned to die, were taken in procession from Newgate Prison in Smithfield, across the city, up by College Green, past the statue of King Billy, and up Grafton Street, and then out by the gallows road. It's called the Gallows Road, and you can see it on this. There's a big gallows. It's kind of a triple, capable of hanging several people at once. And there's not that many descriptions of the processions, but there are one or two interesting ones. One of the description, there was a fellow called John Odwin, and he was a surgeon and who lived in George's Lane. Now, he was convicted in 1727 of killing his servant, Margaret O'Keefe, and he raped and murdered the woman. Now, he was taken from Newgate in procession and a black cart with his cut. So he's waving to people. There's thousands turned out, and he got up and they got to the gallows, and he stood up and he made one of the longest death speeches ever recorded. It was reported that it lasted for 2.5 hours. He spotted somebody who in the crowd who'd given evidence against him, and he called him up and told him that he forgave him. Then he went back, got back to the car, and he tied the noose around his own neck and jumped out. One of the ones that stands out for me, there was a guy called William Wardell. And in 1775, if there can be an amusing aspect to a hanging, this was it. Wardell, he was a habitual criminal, and he'd been in and out of the courts at least 20 odd occasions. But he'd robbed a silver plate from a lady Parsons. So he was sentenced to death. It was just the straw that broke the camel's back. And he was sentenced to death. So again, he was brought to the gallows. Fortunately for him, the normal hangman had retired the week before, and so there was a rookie hangman in his place. So apparently the rookie hangman got up, and instead of tying a noose around poor Wardell's neck, he proceeded to coil it around, just in a circular fashion. And someone from the crowd had to step forward and show him how to tie a noose. And so he was duly dispatched according to the rules of art, as the article went. So this is almost weekly occasion in Dublin during the 18th century. And for most of the 18th century, when I found most of the reports, what struck me was that the exceptional punishments handed down to women. Now, most men were just hanged or hanged and quartered, but some women were actually they were half hanged and then burned.
It was the last execution on the green involving a particularly notorious murderer that saw this brutal punishment meted out to a woman.
The last hanging that ever took place on the green, well, and this actually took place within the confines of the green, was a woman called Mary Fairfield. And she was hanged for the murder of a wet nurse named Mary Byrne. Now, she was convicted along with a Dublin watchman called Constable Funt. There are no details of the actual crime. I think it was the Freeman's Journal report. It was too barbarous to comment any further on this crime. But they'd stopped actually hanging people on the green, but they decided to make an example of Mary Fairfield. Her execution was delayed because there was a thing where when a woman was convicted, she could plead her belly. She could say she was pregnant, and this would delay the execution. So Funt had been executed the year before, but she went before a jury of matrons who decided, yeah, she might be pregnant. So they had to wait it out until it was clear that she wasn't pregnant. So then they decided to go ahead and execute her. So they went back to the green, and the sheriffs, the city sheriff, the county sheriff, and the police had been newly reformed around that time. They just transferred from the old parish watch system to a new organised uniform police. So they wheeled out the police and the horse guards, and they had a procession behind the sheriff and the militia and right across the city. And they took this woman and they half hanged her, and then burned her on a pyre in the middle of Stephen's Green. For what reason, I don't know. But whatever she did, it must have been pretty horrendous, because even the papers wouldn't report fully on what had happened.
Before we move on from the topic of executions, Frank had one last anecdote about the execution of a Catholic bishop that took place in the 16th century. The unfortunate individual in this case was the Bishop of Cashel, Dermot O'Hurley, and his end would make the hairs on the back of your neck stand on end.
Bishop Hurley, he was the Archbishop of Cashel, and he was executed in 1584, as you say. The penal laws were in full swing. Now, he was a very well-educated man. He studied philosophy and law at Louvain and Reims, and he was appointed Archbishop of Cashel 3 years earlier in 1581 by the Pope and sent back to Ireland. But so he returned in disguise to Ireland in 1583, but Elizabeth's spies arrested him and brought him to Dublin Castle. Now, they tried to make him recant his faith and also to inform on other leading Catholics, but he refused. So he refused to say anything. So they subjected him to this torture known as the boots. And they strapped on boots and filled them full of animal fat, tallow and things like that, and set them on fire and tried to make, which must have been, you can only imagine that, how painful and how the horror of all of that. But he still wouldn't recant. And he refused to say anything. So they actually hanged him. at Stephen's Green in 1584 on the 21st of June.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Aside from executions in its early days, Stephen's Green was a pretty unruly place. Riots and casual violence were not uncommon. Frank told me about this particularly chaotic football match that led to the deaths of several people.
Well, one of the best ones that I saw was the butchers and the weavers in 1700. The butchers and the weavers had gathered on the green to have a football match, a 40-a-side football match, but they decided to abandon the football and they decided to have a row instead, and using clubs, pikes, stones, cleavers, and guns. So it was actually a massive riot. The 6 or 7 people were killed, and about 70 were badly injured during this game that got out of hand. But the weavers chased the butchers into their stronghold at Patrick Street. The butchers' wives came out with sticks and stones to attack the weavers, so to help their men folk, and the weavers retaliated by pulling their houses down. So there's 6 or 7 houses demolished during the riot. 6 or 7 people died and 70 badly injured.
Now, Dublin's most famous red light district was in a place called the Monto, located on the other side of the river, which emerged in the mid-19th century. However, as Frank now explains, before the Monto came into existence, Stephen's Green, and in particular a place called Goat Alley, today it's called Diggs Lane, was well known for its brothels. However, some of the men who ventured into Goat Alley lost more than their money.
You see, all through the 1700s and the 1800s, some of the streets around the green were dens of iniquity. There's an infamous place called Goat Alley behind the green. It's now Diggs Lane. And in 1835, John Bramble described it as a second Demora, and he was complaining about the increasing number of miserable outcasts and their companions, robbers and resurrection men who came from Goat Alley, who were frequenting these brothels and running them. The earlier brothels in Goat Alley were infamous for not only the sex workers, I suppose, at the time, were they'd lure in men, watching out for the likes of graziers and farmers come up for the day in the country and invite them back. But not only would they take their money, but they had a particular habit of stripping them of all their clothes. You know, they go back and they wouldn't get to have their way with the women, like be straight in. And there'd be a couple of men waiting there to take their money and then strip them and throw them back out in the street. They had a particular trick as well, catching drunk people on their way home. And they'd wait at the corner. You can imagine Dublin at the time, there was no street lighting and it was really dark. So a drunk man coming home would be fair game. And they'd put a loop on the ground and wait for him to step into the loop, pull the loop tight and drag him into Goat Alley. If I could, I'd like to read you just a little extract about how dangerous it was. There's this book that I came across. It's called Evenings in the Duffery, and it was written by a folklorist called Patrick Kennedy, and it's written in 1869. And he recounted this advice that a friend gave him, warning him to stay clear of Goat Alley. The only real danger won't be near until you get to the city. So if you have any valuable thing to carry from Luke Burns or Francis Street down towards Stephen's Green or the bank, take a couple of men with you out of Luke's house and let one go before and the other one behind. Keep your parcel tightly tucked up under your left arm and a pistol cocked in the right hand. Keep a sharp look out at the corners of Hanover Lane, Drury Lane and Goat Alley. And when you find yourself safe as far as William Street or Stephen's Green, you may put your pistol up. So,
one of the most stunning buildings on the Green today is the Royal College of Surgeons. However, this, like pretty much every other structure on St. Stephen's Green, has its own shady history. Frank began by explaining the background to surgeons and how they emerged in the late Middle Ages.
Back in medieval times, the surgeons were part of it. They were part of a guild along with barbers and apothecaries. But as the years wore on and surgery became more and more sophisticated, they wanted to try and break away from the barbers who they considered beneath them. So eventually they got their way in the late 1784, I think it was, and they were given a royal charter. So at that time, due to Britain's various wars around the globe, they needed more and more surgeons, like particularly during the times of the Napoleonic Wars. The Brits were clamoring for surgeons. Now, they didn't have a premises, the surgeons, so they were basically practicing on dead bodies in their living rooms and things like that.
After getting their first charter in 1784, the surgeons bought a building on Mercer Street. Then in 1810, the Surgeons' College moved to its current location on Stephen's Green. The presence of hundreds of medical students created a demand for cadavers.
The Royal College of Surgeons, as we know it, they moved to the new premises that's on the edge of the Green now, and in 1810, and there was maybe 300 to 400 anatomy students there. So they needed a lot of bodies to practice on.
This led to the emergence of what were called body snatchers, who would steal the bodies of recently deceased people, usually from city graveyards such as Glasnevin and Buddy's Acre, and then sell them to surgeons to practice on. Frank explained how this worked.
These people would go and they get a fresh corpse, they go to Buddy's Acre or to Glasnevin. Bodies weren't buried 6 feet under as they are today, but they'd be just below the surface. So they had this kind of a crude, kind of a loop, a stick with a rope loop on the end of it. So they dig down a few feet, put this loop around the head of the corpse, and they give it a twist and literally drag the bodies out of the ground. And they do carry them across the city then and sell them, usually to surgeons in Mercer Street or to the anatomists of Trinity College. A lot of the college porters were involved in selling the bodies or arranging. They were the middlemen between the body snatchers and the surgeons. The surgeons didn't want to be seen to be involved in this practice, but some of the porters were involved, a guy called Anthony McMahon, Neil Lawler, and probably the most famous of them was a guy called Christy Dixon, who the surgeons tried to sack him a few times, but he had so many. He had so much evidence on most of the surgeons in there that they couldn't sack him in the end.
Frank also told me this story about a certain Michael Farrell, who was one of Dublin's most notorious body snatchers.
There was one particular fella, he was an infamous, he was well known around the city for it. His name was Michael Farrell. And there's one particular case in 1831 where a gang of body snatchers sometimes they didn't even wait for the people to be buried. They invaded a wake in Bow Lane, the nearby Bow Lane, and there was a woman named O'Carroll, an old woman named O'Carroll being waked, and she snatched the body and ran off with it, dragging it through the streets of Dublin. And the poor distraught family went chasing after these people. And they actually went to the College of Surgeons with the police. They knew the body was in there. Well, they were refused entry. So it was a particularly horrific case.
Over the course of our chat, one of the stranger things Frank mentioned about the history of St. Stephen's Green was something called child stripping. Now, this is not what you might think. As Frank explains, this has nothing to do with sexual abuse, but it's something quite different.
When you hear child stripping, like there wasn't a sexual element to it, or But what it was it was mainly perpetrated by middle-aged women. And what they would do, they would get a preferably a wealthy child in the street and lure them away with sweets or the promise of a lollipop, and just take all their fine clothing and strip the child, leave the child there, and just take the clothes to a pawnbroker and get the money for it. There's one case around there's fields behind Stephen's Green called Harcourt Fields. Is another place where people would gather for infamy and kind of to waylay people, and so to bury thieves would bury their booty there. There's a famous case in 1822 when a three-year-old son of a wealthy Thomas Street merchant was kidnapped outside his home and brought to Harcourt Street. He was stripped and abandoned. Now, that child nearly died. Although it was September, it must have been a particularly cold night, because he nearly died from hypothermia, I presume. And the woman that took him was never caught. But it was a very commonplace thing in Dublin and big city. I've seen them described on a couple of occasions as, for some reason, and I don't know what the connection is, shoulers, like the people who perpetrated this type of crime. But it was just an economic crime, really, you know.
Among the many attractions on St. Stephen's Green today is the countless bars and nightclubs. The most famous, or notorious, depending on your view, is a place called Copperface Jack's, located on Harcourt Street, just off the Green. While this has a somewhat legendary reputation today, the man who it's named after was quite the character. The story you're about to hear is one to file under best nightmare neighbour story you're ever going to come across.
Copperface Jack, he was a Tipperary born, and he's known as a hanging judge. He's called Copperface. His name was John Scott. He'd been Solicitor General, Attorney General, and Lord Chief Justice of Ireland. He was called Copperface Jack because he had an exceptionally red face, because he loved the gargle. It was said of him that he used to have two able-bodied lackeys on standby every night, waiting outside whatever tavern he was in with his mate, the equally disreputable sham squire who lived around the corner from Francis Higgins. So he'd have two lads waiting outside to carry him home every night after his drunken rampages. And he was quite corrupt. He was universally hated, even by all of the barristers and in his courts. One of his most famous things that he's famous for, he had a long-running battle with the editor of the Dublin Evening Post, a guy called John McGee. Copperface Jack and his friend, the Sham Squire, they organised to have him arrested on trumped-up libel charge, and Copperface Jack locked him up. He put it to really excessive bail of about, I think it was 10 grand at the time, which was a lot of money. So McGee couldn't afford this, so he landed in Newgate for a long time. But he sat in Newgate brooding over this, and he swore when he got out, he plastered all over his papers that he was going to get even with Copperface Jack, that he had 10 grand and he was going to spend it all and getting his revenge on Copperface Jack. So what he did was, Copperface Jack had a house out in Monkstown called Templeville. So McGee bought the adjoining land, and he used to advertise carnivals in every Saturday kind of thing. He'd provide free drink, to be climbing up greasy poles, to be football matches there. And the things just turned into riotous assemblies. There was an estimated 10,000 people at one of these parties. What he got a number of shaved pigs and set them loose. And McGee, he said, if you catch one, you can keep them. The pig was a valuable commodity in the 1700s, and the pigs ran into Copperface Jack's beautifully manicured lawns and gardens. And within half an hour, the place was destroyed. Jack eventually got the last laugh on McGee when he managed to jail him for nearly 2 years for contempt.
Now, without question, the bizarrest individual associated with St. Stephen's Green was a certain Mr. A. Hitler, who was known to frequent the area in the early 20th century. It's not Adolf, but his lesser known half-brother Aloysius.
This guy, I think it was in 1910, so this woman was at the horse show with her father. Her name was Bridget Dowling. I think she's from somewhere out Talloway. But this handsome man approached her and her father and started talking to them. And his name turned out that his name was Alois Hitler. While he was here, he was working in the Shelburne as a waiter. And it turns out that he was Adolf Hitler's half-brother. So against her father's wishes, she eloped with this handsome guy and they went to Liverpool. And Bridget's father tried to have Hitler charged with kidnapping, but it never came to anything. And they went to live in Liverpool. Their marriage only lasted for four years. Hitler abandoned the family and became a razor blade salesman. And he faked his own death and married again. Now, Bridget and Alois Hitler, they had a son called William Patrick. So William Patrick, and as Adolf Hitler came to power in later years, William and his mother tried to exploit the relationship with the Führer. And young William asked Adolf for a job. And Hitler wrote back to him saying he couldn't be seen to be giving his family any favours and that. Now, Bridget wrote her biography in 1944, I think it was, and she tried to exploit her relationship. She claimed that he'd come to visit her in Liverpool, which never happened. She said all sorts of things. She said she claimed that she had advised him to trim his moustache, and she said that he'd stayed with her in Liverpool in 1913.
Thanks to Frank for sitting down with me. I really enjoyed making that episode. Now, we only scratched the surface. There's lots more great stories in Frank's book, St. Stephen's Green, A History of the Green and Its Environs. You can find that in the show notes below. There won't be an episode next week, but I will be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, slán.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Peace with an A, B-I, and then Peace with an I. Thank you so much.